Hey, welcome to another week of Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. Lauren Fox.
And Andrew Hansen.
And today is a special day.
It is. Today's Friday.
It is Friday, but
It's March. It's toward the end of March.
It's going to be weird because later in the show, we interview Marty Myers, the coach of the Bedford High hockey team that won states.
Yes.
And we're going to be referring to Thursday and Thursday night. So we're going to get into a time machine in about 15 minutes and go backwards.
Yeah, it's like a double time machine because today is Friday.
And then we're going to go forwards.
We're going to go backwards, then forwards.
Yes. So that's the plan. That's what I'm going
to
do.
But, you know, and it's not a bad week to do that because in the first week of the NCAA tournament, which is one of the greatest weeks of the year, anything you're doing where you're sort of trying to get a sense of where you are, but you know that you're on Thursday and Friday and or Friday is a good thing.
Yes.
So, it's a good place to be.
Yeah, we're Thursday and Friday both, unless you have more work to do, in which case it will just follow me for the weekend.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, it's the name of the game. So today is a special day because it's March Madness Day 2.
Right.
And it's the March Madness Celebration Day because they mentioned it on ESPN this morning that these are a couple of the best sports days of the year. And I would say that yesterday was a great day with Ichiro retiring first thing in the morning, which, I mean, I wasn't happy about that part, but the fact that you got basically baseball's equivalent of breakfast at Wimbledon in the morning, you got a game first thing, although the perfect scenario would have been like a nice outdoor, you know, Dodger Stadium with palm trees and sun and summer.
Instead, well, that game would have had to start at 2 a.m.
Right.
Local time.
True. Instead, we got the Tokyo Dome, which that was okay. And so we started the day with that, then rolled into more basketball, and it was basically
lots and lots of basketball.
Lots and lots of basketball. It was basketball all day. And the kind of the bummer I have about this first weekend of the NCAA tournament is once it's over, it's over.
I know.
We don't get it every week.
It's a 2-day blur, Thursday, Friday.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, you're back to like a somewhat normal day where on Saturday and Sunday you have 8 games a day instead of 16 per day.
Right. And the cut-ins, like, that's the fun tonight when we'll be sitting there watching it and it's just a cut-in to a cut-in to a cut-in and your heads are spinning and you're like, wait a second, I can't believe that UMBC is going to beat Virginia and destroy everybody's bracket. I don't see the one beating the 16 this year.
Yeah, I think everybody's going to be on high alert after that upset last year at this on this same day, late on the Friday night.
Yeah, that one was crazy. Now, this year, it all sort of went pretty close to according to Hoyle yesterday. There wasn't a whole lot of weirdness on day one, but I seem to remember the same sort of thing happening last year where you had the non-weirdness, and then all of a sudden it was like somebody just knocked over the ant farm and ants were crawling all over the place.
Yeah, and that's a problem for me because a lot of the upsets I picked on day one, here we are on Friday morning, were very, very close, and they just barely failed.
New Mexico State, Auburn.
New Mexico State, we got to start there.
Okay.
Because that was one of the most incredible finishes you will ever see at any level. New Mexico State is down by 2, so their guard pushes it up the court, gets ahead of the defenders, and he's at layup range, down by 2 with about 3 seconds left at that juncture. And all of a sudden, he goes Rajon Rondo and passes up an almost sure layup, which would have tied the game and sent it to overtime. This is a 12-5 matchup. New Mexico State has all the momentum, so if they get into overtime, they've got a great chance to beat Auburn. But instead of taking the left-handed layup, he makes a 10 out of 10 challenge pass back over his right shoulder to the three-point land. His teammate misses the three, but luckily gets fouled. Auburn makes a terrible play. So then he goes to the line for those 3 free throws with a chance to win. He only makes one of them.
Yeah.
And it was just amazing occurrence after amazing occurrence because now there's 1.1 on the clock and New Mexico State gets another chance to win with a wide open 3 in the left corner. And the guy who's made 4 three-pointers in the game misses in that really challenging clutch situation. So New Mexico State has all these chances to either tie or win in the last 5 seconds. They don't do it, and Auburn survives and advances.
Well, that was a bizarre one, too, because within that, you had New Mexico State 16 of 18 from the free throw line in the first 38 minutes of the game. And in the last 2 minutes of the game, they were 4 of 9. So for anybody who tells you that there's no such thing as being clutch or performing in the clutch, that would be Exhibit A. I mean, you're shooting, what, 8 out of 9, 89% from the free throw line, and then it drops to 44% in the last 2 minutes of the game when obviously those guys are like, they can see it and they can feel it and they can taste it. And we're going to be the 12 over the five. But instead, the 12 over the five was
Murray State.
There you go.
And that was the upset that a lot more people picked because of Ja Morant. And he really showed up when the lights were brightest with an incredible triple-double. 17 points, 11 rebounds, 16 assists. That's the most assists ever in a triple-double in the NCAA tournament. First triple-double since Draymond Green back in 2012. And he did it with flair. I mean, he's got the step-back
37 pieces of flair?
Yes. Jennifer Aniston?
Yeah.
Step-back three to end the half, where he looks like James Harden. Then he's got a couple of terrific passes, one-handed with his left hand, even though he's righty. Then he had that highlight reel dunk.
Yeah.
I mean, he did it all.
He's fun and he's useful. And, you know, what I haven't seen that I really want to see tape of is that AAU team that he was playing on with Zion.
Oh, my gosh.
Like, when somehow, like, can you... It still just blows my mind because you hear it happen so many times that a scout goes to watch the shortstop and the shortstop really doesn't do anything for him, but he sees this pitcher who all of a sudden just starts dealing and he does his best to kind of, he writes his report, he files everything and the shortstop this and the pitcher that, but I really hope that nobody else saw this guy and obviously other people see him and then all of a sudden this guy starts shooting up people's draft boards. Like you see stories about that all the time. The interesting thing to me is that for all the schools that were watching Zion Williamson and watching that AAU team is that nobody looked at Ja Morant and went, that guy looks like he's all right. I think I'll grab him. And I don't think with Zion, I don't think there were a whole lot of schools that really had a chance at him. And so maybe that was it. Maybe it was just that the big ones were going and knowing that they were the ones with a shot and nobody else was scouting it because why waste any time? But somehow Ja Morant slipped through everybody. All the power conferences, he just went right through and wound up with Murray State. And, you know, we've been watching this guy. I first saw him on ESPN probably 3-4 months ago. And you say, this guy's just special because he was on, it seemed like twice a week, he was on top 10 for his dunks.
Yeah, that would be fascinating to interview some of those coaches, assistant coaches who were recruiting Zion and to find out what their mentality was, what those scouting reports were about Ja Morant. They did talk about it yesterday during the game, and the background they gave on it was that he was, I think the term they used was lightly recruited. So he was recruited at multiple Division I programs, but the advice he got, I believe it was from his father, was go to the place that really wants you. And he decided in the end, Murray State really wants me. There may be some other decent D1 programs where I'm being recruited, I could get a scholarship, but I don't really know how invested they are in me and how committed they are to me. So he went where they really wanted him, and boy, did that work out, because he's still going to be a top 2 or 3 pick. So it really didn't hurt him in the end.
Well, and the same thing, I would give the advice to anybody in any sport, like you want to go where you're going to, in this day and age, and you watch top 10 on any given morning and you're seeing things from the European, whatever, Premier League soccer, and you're seeing things from, this is the Ohio State, what was it, the number two or number three was a kid making a shot from his backside, from the ground, a little 10-footer from the baseline in the Ohio State semifinals. And
high school basketball?
Yeah, and in this day and age, if you're doing amazing things, somebody will find you somehow. It will be a video on
you. You can't hide.
You can't hide. Like you think about even what it was probably 20 years ago. Do you remember the name Toe Nash?
Was he a baseball player?
He was a baseball player. He never made the major leagues, but he was
the Louisiana.
He was the Louisiana guy who was hitting like 400-foot home runs from both sides of the plate, and they found him in like this Sunday league playing barefoot.
Right.
And he went, and at the time, the Devil Rays signed him. They were interested in drafting, I guess, whoever they could, because they drafted or they signed Jim Morris, too, who was 36 years old at that point, the rookie. But they had Toe Nash in their system, and he was one that washed out simply because, for him, the idea, it was just too much of a stretch. Sometimes you get the bright lights and you're the story and you're just not really prepared for it. Nothing in life has prepared you for that. But he was one that the scouts saw and basically said, we have to hide this guy.
Right.
Like, he's throwing 90 miles an hour. He's hitting 400-foot home runs from both sides of the plate. We need to hide this guy and just offer him a contract and he'll sign it. And he did. And unfortunately, he washed out. But you look at Morant and guys like that, the advice that I would, his dad was completely right. The advice that I'd give to anybody, if whether it's baseball, football, you name it, like, yeah, there are times, Matt Cassel is one that I would use as an example, but he's really a bizarre example. Cassel never took a snap at USC. And if he did, he didn't throw a pass. He played tight end. And the only reason that somebody signed him, I don't even remember if he was drafted, the only reason somebody signed him was because Pete Carroll said, hey, this guy's all right. He's just been sitting behind Matt Leinart for a while.
Right.
But times, the stories like that are few and far between. It's, you're more likely at this point to be seen if you're actually getting reps. Same advice somebody gave me years ago when I was getting into broadcasting, and I had a great opportunity to go to Charleston, South Carolina, and be the number three guy and travel occasionally. And I talked to a handful of people in business, and they said, go where you can get as many innings as you can get, because that will make you a better broadcaster, not doing a pre and a post game show and two innings a game. And it was really sound advice. You turn down what is still one of the marquee franchises in minor league baseball, owned by Mike Vec, Bill Murray, all those guys, which that's a pretty killer opportunity. But you turn that down for the opportunity to do more innings. It's the same thing. Like, you need, somehow you need to have somebody see you, get the reps that you might not have been able to get otherwise. And he did it, and it's going to turn out just fine for him.
Yeah, he is. And he's joining elite company with that triple-double. And I found the list of the triple-doubles in the last 35 years. There's been less than 10 in the NCAA tournament. Some of these names really surprised me. Did you happen to see this list?
No.
So,
where are we?
Well, I'm going to ask you about a couple of the
yeah.
entries.
Okay.
And I'm not going to expect you to know the answer, because prior to Draymond Green, he had a triple-double in 2012 and one the year before in 2011. The player before that was a Kansas Jayhawk. So I'll give you one or two guesses at which Kansas Jayhawk in the last 20 years recorded a triple-double in the NCAA tournament.
In the NCAA tournament? Like, give me an era.
Last 20 years.
Last 20 years?
Yeah.
Oh, geez.
First guy to come to mind.
I'm trying to think of guards. Jared Haas.
Okay.
Jacques Vaughn.
Jacques Vaughn is a good guess. I mean, the guy, because you have to be able to get 10 assists.
You're right.
Right.
Or 10 blocks or steals.
Or 10 blocks or steals.
So, I mean, I was going, is it a Wayne Simeon? Maybe.
He is
Nick Collison.
Simeon could fill up a stat sheet.
You know, and then you start thinking about that Miles, like Arthur Miles, you know, that group of people. God, who was it who had that 3-pointer blocked against Syracuse in the corner?
I've tried to block
Lee.
It out of my mind.
No, Lee. Who was it? Mario Chalmers.
Nope, you'd have to go to blocks.
Blocks, really?
Yep.
Ostertag?
No. A little bit more recent than that.
Who?
Cole Aldrich.
Oh, God, no, really?
Can you believe
that's
that?
That's gross, dude.
In the last 15 years.
Cole Aldrich?
In the last 15 years.
He's
the only
footnote.
The only players to get a triple-double in the NCAA tournament. Ja Morant, Draymond Green, and Cole Aldrich.
Three people who have not been in my kitchen.
And you didn't even mention Paul Pierce.
No, I know.
I mean, you think about all these star KU guys.
I thought that was past 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Aldrich is a weird one, though. You could have given me 30 tries and I never would have named
him. Right, so that's why I said I wasn't expecting you
no.
to get him. I mean, who would have?
Yeah.
And then the guy before that, you would, and you probably heard, because he did it for Marquette, Dwayne Wade.
Oh, D-Wade, yeah, of course.
And then the guard before that, back in 1998, Andre Miller at Utah.
Yeah, of course.
So, and then Shaquille O'Neal is on the list. He's the one other guy who did it with blocks. So just, I mean, that just goes to show you, all these star players who've gone through that tournament have not done it.
Yeah. It's, you know, it's harder to do in the NCAA because you have a 40-minute clock instead of 48. Just for a variety of reasons, it's harder. But, impressive to see him do that yesterday. I would not mind sparing people the monotony of going through game by game.
We don't need to go through game by game, but let's talk about the upper left here, the East, where yep. the two of the upsets I picked were heartbreaking failures that you picked the favorite to win.
Yep.
So you've got the edge in the first round here without actually tallying everything up. And those were the Belmont loss to Maryland.
Yep.
Where that was really exciting to see this Windler left-hander score 35 points.
Yeah.
He's 6'8". He's fun to watch. He's got a little game. And I thought they really were the better team. They deserved to win, and it just didn't work out at the end. And by the way, did you see that final play where they tried to get it to him on the back door? I thought that was a terrific play, and it just didn't work out. But so Belmont was one.
Yeah, I went with the chalk on that one. I had Maryland. I had LSU. And you give this stuff more thought than I do. Like, I was sitting there, what was it, yesterday morning saying, I need to get my picks in, and just jamming through them. So having gotten burned by picking the wrong upsets last year, I went largely with the chalk unless I had a really captivating reason not to. And in the case of LSU, I think anybody who listened to last week's show, so all one of you know exactly how I feel about LSU, but I still think they have a good basketball team. I hold grudges about the fact that USC was absolutely robbed of being in the national championship game in 2004 in favor of LSU.
In football.
Yes, in football. And also USC was punished for things that were never failures of institutional control. LSU will probably get a slap on the wrist and just get right back after it again. Like, go get them, boys.
Right.
But I can put that prejudice aside and say, I think they're a Sweet 16 team. I think they'll destroy Maryland.
That's wise of you. That's wise of you. And so on that one, I went with Yale. And the frustrating thing on that is Yale only lost by 5. So they're right there till the very end.
Yep.
Their star player, Oney, Ivy League Player of the Year, only had 5 points. He went 2 for 16 from the field, 1 of 10 on threes. So if he has an average game,
right,
they win. The team went 8 for 37 on threes. So it's one of those games where you've got this Ivy League underdog who's actually a legit team and capable of beating a top three seed. And if they just have an average game shooting, they would have won. And their star player just had one of those off games. So that was the other close one that didn't work out. So when you talk about, you know, strategy on these brackets, we started talking about it off air before we started. I'm in a pool where if the scoring system is a lot different. If you pick an upset, and let's say it's the 14 seed Yale, you get 14 points for it.
Right. I'm in one that's the same way, where it rewards you for picking the upset, but guess what happens if you pick an upset that doesn't come to fruition?
You miss out on the
0 points.
Yeah, you miss out on the 3 points that you get with LSU. But then in the second round, in this pool, it multiplies.
Okay.
So now in the second round, you get twice the 14 seed. So you get 28 points if they win in the second round.
Yep.
So to win that pool, you really have to take more risks and pick some of these underdogs. So in that pool, I had Belmont and Yale, both upsets, and then meeting in that second round. So then if you pick the winner of that one,
right,
you've got that double whammy.
You get the multiplier.
You get the multiplier.
It's double jeopardy when the scores can really change.
That's right.
Yeah.
So it is fun to see these different pools. You really need different strategies based on the rules.
You do. And so we both have Duke in the finals. And, you know, the funny thing, I didn't change my strategies. I just went. Like,
well, when you're under the time crunch,
yeah,
you got to do what you got to do.
And then copied it on CBS Sportsline. You can copy it from one to the other. And
CBS is set up rocking. Quite well.
It's great.
Yeah.
We'll get back to the kind of the crux of the picks. But so you produced a blank bracket for me.
Can you? Yeah.
Right.
Well, so it's not completely blank.
Well, no, it has the first round in it.
It has the names of the teams on it.
Quote, second round teams.
You know, they actually changed it now.
Okay.
They finally figured it out. They're calling it the first four and then the first round.
All right. That was bugging me.
That was.
So
they cleaned that up.
I'm going to take it way back for the kids because I want them to know what it was like back in the day. So here's what we did back in the day, right? Before there was this internet thing and the Facebooks and all those Snap Face and whatever.
The world did exist.
The world
back
existed,
then.
Oddly enough. So we would call each other up using rotary phones. no. So I would wait for the LA Times and I would get the LA Times and go find a Kinko's and somehow do my very best to take the bracket and smush it on the glass at the Kinko's and shrink it, and then shrink it again, and then copy however many of those that I thought that I would need and bring them to high school. And we would do our brackets at high school, or in college, just leave them on the table at the fraternity house with an envelope, and people would, this is before the Venmo, before the PayPal, people would just, or and Apple Pay, people would just give me just leave the $5, and you'd be on the honor system, just leave me the $5, leave it in my locker or whatever, we're good. And the real pain in the neck was, like, I woke up this morning and I went to CBS and I'm like, oh great, I'm in whatever place in this pool. I was in 115th out of 199. No bueno. Jenny was 36th out of 199. She's doing better. But if KU doesn't win the whole thing, she's toast. So I would go and check. That
sounds familiar to our household.
Right. There was this. But back in the day, I would have this stack of 100 things in $500 in my sock drawer. And I'd have to go through with a highlighter and go tick, 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 tick.
And manually update the standings.
Update the stupid standings and... You know, and inevitably, because people are impatient, it would be like 10 the next morning, dude, how am I doing in the pool? I'm going to wring your neck. I have homework.
Never said that. You never once said that. I can't do that because I have homework.
No, probably
at college.
Not. No. I just had other things to do. but then you take all that stuff. Then you go ahead to work. We used to have a partner at the accounting firm that I worked at he would build into the pool that he was paying his kid $50 to tabulate it for.
Of course.
So we would have to wait for Adam Denkberg to tabulate all of our pools. The funny thing is I'm still in that pool now. It still exists. It's in like year 21 or year 22 or something like all
well,
these years later.
If it's an accounting firm, was there some sort of computer model that would actually tabulate those standings a little bit more easily than your yellow highlighter in college?
Interestingly enough, yeah, those dudes would build macros and like there would be Visual Basic Excel garbage going, like just way smarter than I am. But people would put this stuff together and make life a little bit easier. But so kids today, you don't know how easy you have it. You just enter your brackets in and the scores pop up. And if your team gets knocked out the rest of the way, they turn red.
That's
so,
right.
I mean, it really looks like college tests.
It really makes it easy. But the funny thing is, there is one thing in today's day and age that is a lot more difficult than back in those days when we would go to the newspaper to get the brackets. And that is being able to find a bracket that you can print out that has all of the names of the teams that are playing each other and their seeds. And forget about what time they're playing or where they're playing. It took me 15 minutes to print out this bracket that you and I filled out that has the names of the teams, because you Google it and all the previous year's brackets come up and all these things that have like a copyright on them. And yeah, we don't have to deal with dial-up anymore. That's what it felt like, though. This is what I felt like I was doing.
Am I going to get on? Am I going to get on? Am I going to get on? Wait for it.
Wait for it.
Ugh, it's going to be tough. Sweet. All right.
Can I get what I want?
Yes. I'm in.
Oh,
now
I'm in.
I can do it.
And then it's going to take another 50 minutes. Well, that's what it was like, just trying to find a bracket to print out. So if you find a site that you like that does this, bookmark it for next year.
Right. So, yes. So anyway, who are your final four? Or do you want to go through your Elite Eight? Would that be easier?
Yeah, Elite Eight.
All right.
So I went pretty chalky because I haven't watched as much college basketball this year as I'd like, but everything I'm hearing and sensing is that in the end, the ones and two seeds are a lot better than the threes and below.
I just realized what I did and I just threw up in my mouth a little bit.
Uh-oh.
I went 1-2 in all four.
Oh, really?
All four.
See, there you go.
Yep.
So I diverted from that in one spot, but so yeah, I went Duke, Michigan State, which you must have as well.
Yep.
Virginia, Tennessee, North Carolina,
yep.
Kentucky.
That's so boring.
Gonzaga and Buffalo.
So for Harry.
Harry certainly influenced that. He's talked about Buffalo nonstop. But I just love their coach. I love the success they had last year in the tournament.
Yep.
And I am not overwhelmed with Michigan down in the West. So I've got Buffalo in the Elite Eight. And then I've got Tennessee in the Final Four.
Tennessee.
That was... My one upset there. and UNC over Duke to try and get a little edge on the field.
I could not go Red Sox-Yankees in the finals. I just couldn't do it. Like, as much as I think that UNC would beat Virginia, I couldn't do it. I couldn't go Duke-UNC.
So you went with strategy, sort of game theory,
trying
to beat the field.
Yeah, I went with University of Virginia winning the whole thing, even though that kind of makes me sick. But the storyline that goes with that is you go from getting knocked out in the first round, the only one seed to get knocked out in the first round ever, to winning the championship the next year, which everybody will love that narrative.
That would be terrific.
You know, that's going to be the Tony Bennett. Look what he did. Somehow he was able to marshal all these resources, and now his team's winning the whole thing. So, I don't know. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll come right back with Bedford High hockey coach Marty Myers. We're going to act like it just happened, even though it happened yesterday. You're listening to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. Welcome back to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. Lauren Fox, Andrew Hansen, and we are joined by Bedford High hockey coach Marty Myers, fresh off a nice 7-0 win in the finals over Trinity. Coach, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it was certainly a lot of fun to watch the team last week, or what was that, a week and a half ago, 2 weeks ago? 7-0 in the finals. I think all of us, Hansen and I included, looked at it and saw the previous two games that were overtime nail-biters. In fact, we're still a little bit peeved. You guys preempted us for one of the basketball games by having a double overtime game after St. A's and SNU delayed you by about 45 minutes. But you look at the quarters and the semis and you say, God, this is going to be a tight one till the end. And the boys just busted it open, 1-7-0. Were you expecting that it was going to be that lopsided of a game?
Not at all. Not at all. Like you said, the previous two games and playoff games usually are usually a 1-2 goal type of game. And after the previous quarterfinals, semifinals, we were actually expecting another tight game. I'll be honest with you, I was pleasantly surprised.
I don't know. I kind of, as a sports fan, I kind of flash back to some things like the 1985 World Series. Hansen will know what I was talking about. You have a very pivotal Game 6 that was decided on one of the most controversial calls of all time. And then Game 7's the afterthought. That was the 11-1, 11-0 game. It almost had that kind of a feeling to it. And based upon looking at the history of both teams, I don't think anybody was really expecting that.
No, playing them in the regular season, I'll be honest with you, they played us well. They surprised us. That game went into overtime, and they ended up beating us by a goal. I believe it was the final score was 5-4. So the regular season game, which was only like 3 weeks prior to this final game, it was a different outcome, and it was a much tighter game.
Coach, as Lauren and I were there watching the third period, we started talking how the only drama really was, will the Bulldogs secure the shutout here? But prior to the third period in that championship game, what do you think was the turning point for your guys?
You know what? I thought the first period was pretty tight. I know that we limited their shots. I think the second shot of the game, they hit the post. It was still 0-0 at the time, and they hit the post on us. So ending the first period, it was only 1-0. But I think halfway through the second period, Parker Rivero getting two goals in the second period, I think that started to change the tide a little bit. I think we kept them deep in their own end. I thought we controlled the game pretty well, and I thought the team was playing good.
Here with Coach Marty Myers of the Bedford High hockey program, the state champs, and it's always funny. You go back, you look at the way that a season works out, and it almost tends to go in chapters, and there's always some sort of narrative form where it has ups and downs, and as the head coach, you're part psychologist, part puppet master, really, as it is. Early in the season, the team looked great. They hit a couple bumps in the road and then righted the ship and I'm not going to say cruised, but ultimately won the state title. When that happens, when you have those little hiccups during the season, how do you make sure that everything goes back into the right direction?
You know what, I think every season, I think there's no perfect season, and every season has that type of that type of course where teams play well, then they get off track, and then hopefully they get back on track. And this was no different for us. And I think what happened when we started to struggle a little bit, I think we didn't panic. I think we believed in what we did and how we did it, but we just needed to be a little more consistent in doing the things that we did. So I think the kids did a really good job of focusing on the positive, working consistently hard every game, every practice. And I don't think they really ever panicked or thought that they didn't believe that they could be successful.
And really, that's one of the most critical things is if a team believes and they're unified in a belief that they can do it, it really makes a big difference for you. It makes your job a lot easier, although it's, again, you're playing part psychologist. Things go down, you have to bring them up a little bit. Things get a little bit too high. You can't, you have to sort of keep things at a happy medium as much as you can. For you, in a season that was full of highlights, what was your favorite moment?
You know what, this was a very good season for us. And I think, obviously one of the highlights is always playing in the final game. Playing in the final game, obviously it has a lot of meaning for the state title. But you know what, when you're going through the playoffs, it's win or go home. And you know what, that uncertainty of going into the rink thinking that, you know what, if you don't win, you know, this team isn't going to be, in existence. And that's an odd feeling. But going into the final game, knowing that this is it, win, lose, or draw, that this is going to be it, there's a sense of relief, there's a sense of, being complete, where you can say the things that you need to say because you know at the end of it, it's done. So I think that's the most exciting part of it, is going into the final game, having the opportunity to win a state title and to end it with your players, I say, the way we like to end it, knowing that there's no other games, there's no other tournaments after this. So it's a sense of completion.
Well, Coach, you sure ended it in outstanding fashion. And as we looked down at the ice in that championship game, we saw a lot of blonde hair from the Bedford players. Tell us about how that tradition started in your program, and I'm really interested in team chemistry. So how you think that sort of team bonding contributed to the team success this year?
It's actually a funny story. It started about 3-4 years ago. The kids were talking about, doing something to bring the team together, right, to kind of unite getting into the playoffs. And they brought me in and they said, hey, this is what we're thinking. This is what we want to do. And I'll be honest with you, I didn't want to do it. I didn't know what the parents were going to think about it. I didn't like the idea of bleaching their hair prior to even playing in a playoff game because, right, you bleach your hair, you play a game and you lose. You look kind of silly. So I was really against it.
Yep.
I really was. But you know what? The kids and the team really banded together, right? They came to me again in a unified manner and said, Coach, this is something, you know what, win, lose, or draw, we want to do. We'd like your approval on it. And I think it's going to work. And I was very hesitant. I really was. I was very hesitant. But at the end of the day, I said, if everyone agreed, if one person didn't agree, then we don't move forward with it. And I went around the room and I had everyone stand if they wanted to do it. And on the count of three, the entire team stood, and that's what they did. So from that point on, every year, the kids bleach their hair, and they really do. They really do have a good time doing it. No one's forced to do it. They all go down to the same hair salon. They get their hair done, spend the day, and it's actually a pretty good team chemistry, and it's something that I tried to talk them out of it again this year, and they said that they wanted to do it, so it's something that they found that works, and who am I to stand in the way?
It's the Bedford High hockey team Day of Beauty. We go to the salon. it's funny though. I think, what is it, 28 years ago that I was a senior in high school, and we started off our baseball season slow and made a decision as a team that we were all going to shave our heads, and all of a sudden went on what, like a 9-10 game winning streak. It's funny how those little things can help you. You can pick out your teammates across campus and immediately go, oh, there he is. I was a baseball tryouts earlier this week. It's obvious who the hockey players are because they have these shockingly yellow heads. So it really is a badge for those guys.
It really is. It's something that not only is it something that they did and will remember. It's going to be something that they're going to always remember what they did their senior year, junior year, freshman year. And look back on. I mean, it's kind of silly, but you know what? That's, you know, it's kids, and you know what? This is the age and the time for them to do it. You know, I know some of them are going for college interviews, and they're going to get their hair bleached back to their normal color. So it is harmless. It's something fun, and more importantly, it's something that they band together, and they'll always, you know, have a memory.
Well, even if you're in a college interview and somebody asks you, why is your hair yellow dyed like that, it gives you an immediate conversation piece. So there is that. We're with Coach Marty Myers of the state champion Bedford High hockey program. And in high school, one of the most difficult things is you're always losing players, getting new ones. And at this age, the growth and development that a kid can have in the offseason, if they work on it, can give you a different player the next year. Who are some of the big losses that you'll sustain going into next season?
Yeah, we had a really good senior, very fortunate to have a very talented senior class. My first line, my top line, consisted of three seniors, Parker Roberto, Jack Sylvain, and Jake San Clemente. They did the majority of the scoring for our team this year. They really played well, and the deeper the season went, the more important the game was or the situation was. Those three kids came up big consistently.
It makes a big difference when you have those senior leaders. And then for you, you try to pencil out before the season starts who your lines are going to be and where everybody's going to sort of slot in. But there are always pleasant surprises that happen that make it so that somebody kind of elbows their way in. There's an injury, you name it. But who were some of your pleasant surprises this season?
Yeah, we were fairly young. We carried a lot of sophomores this year. We carried a freshman this year. And the sophomore class really surprised me. We had Owen Roberto, Alex Lobdell, Will Scott, and Quinlan Kerr. These four boys, they're all sophomores. They played a ton of minutes for me. They were very productive, and they really, really surprised me. In addition to that, I had a freshman, Brett Nallen. He was the only freshman on the team that we had this season, and he really was effective, again, offensively, defensively. And if I had to point to the most surprising player that we had on the team, was Shea Guimont, who was our goalie. He's a sophomore. He had a spectacular season, and as the season went on, he seemed like he just got stronger and more confident with every save. So he really stepped up. I'm really anxious to see how he's going to progress over the next two seasons.
Well, and of course, you mentioned Shea, that late save to preserve the shutout in that 7-0 win. It's nice when it's a nice clean 7-0. It felt a lot better, I think, for all of us in the stands. There was still, as Hanson mentioned, there was still a little bit of tension that went along with it. Well, thank you for joining us. We know the banquet's tonight, and enjoy that, and enjoy a little bit of off season before you're back at it again.
Thank you guys for inviting me on the show.
Hey, anytime.
Congrats again, Coach. Take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
That was Coach Marty Myers from the Bedford High Hockey Program, fresh off a state title. Always good to see that. And it was even more fun to see it in person.
Yeah, it really was. And it was fun to talk about that team chemistry. You mentioned your high school baseball team. We also did it on the basketball team senior year.
Are we going to do it now?
No.
In the BMBL?
We could.
We have too many bald guys.
I mean,
I'm not shaving my head.
That's right. We do have too much bald hair. But yeah, we did it senior year heading into the playoffs. It wasn't quite as sophisticated as these guys apparently with going to the salon, and it looked like they, when they dyed it blonde, it actually really worked quite well. We did it at my parents' house, and our heads came out a mixture of yellowish, orangish. I mean, it wasn't like a uniform,
yeah,
perfectly,
but it was something.
It was something, and it was, you could tell when you looked, okay, they did something to their hair, and it was supposed to be unified, and it led to a state championship.
The when we did ours, we all did it at a team dinner. And I don't remember, we were at somebody's house having a pasta dinner the night before the game, and somebody came up with the idea, and we all just started going and shaving our heads. And one guy didn't do it. And this is the kind of thing that really illustrates the difference between 1991 and 2019. Didn't do it, was the outlier, and then a couple days later, a couple guys went to his house and shaved his head.
Oh,
you would be tossed out of school on your head. I think Corey Parker just had chills go up the back of his neck when I mentioned that. You can't do that stuff anymore.
Well, it's funny you mentioned Corey Parker, because when we did it, our athletic director was not thrilled about it.
Yeah.
And we had not gone to him and stood in a room and voted, and everybody got to stand up.
No.
It was a little bit more of a surprise,
right,
to the administration.
Right.
But I think the fact that it worked sort of softened the blow a little bit.
Yeah.
But I do like how Coach Myers did that in a way that he said, all right, you know, I'm open to this, but only if we're all on the same page.
Yeah.
And I think that's a great thing.
Yeah, I think it is something that you have to do. It makes it a team thing instead of here's a bunch of guys and here's one guy. You know, and you see it sometimes in team photos where everybody says we're going to mean mug and we're all just going to look like we're serious, and then there's one guy smiling over in the corner. So it I think is testament to how they were as a team. It's testament to him as a coach, making it almost a democratic process and making it a part of the tradition. And you better bet that this is something that'll get carried on, just because they want to do it. Like, it's worked, so keep it rolling. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. It's Thursday today. We're recording this part of the show, and then I have to work, and then tomorrow's March Madness Day, so we're going to do like a truncated half of the show. But I was watching SportsCenter this morning, and they did a little live cut-in, and we're talking about Ichiro.
Yes, we are. Yes, Kitsune.
My guy.
Kitsune, we are talking about Ichiro.
I almost started crying. I was really trying not to.
It was emotional. That was quite a scene.
So he wound up, and it was not Ted Williams homering in his final at-bat at Fenway, which really bummed me out. But, you know, you take what you can get. Ichiro was out there in right field for the Mariners. He announced today that today was going to be his last game, which I kind of is what you expect from Ichiro. It's not quite John Kruk, I'm going to take my ball and go home, but it was Ichiro just kind of doing it in perfect. He played to type. The only thing, and Dave Fleming was doing play-by-play. Did you watch a game?
Yeah.
Fleming was doing play-by-play, and it was like he didn't want to jinx it. And Fleming's had some nice big things on his resume. He got Barry Bonds. I think he got home run number 62 or 756. He got one of them. But he said, I think it's the seventh inning, he says, or the eighth inning, the perfect ending, what the perfect ending would be. But he didn't actually say what it was. And I think we all knew what it was. It was in the first pitch that he saw from Joaquin Soria was a fastball away. Fastball away, Ichiro's lefty. So the perfect Ichiro thing would have been slap that in the 5.5 hole, get himself a single, and that's it.
And it would have been an RBI single
to win
the game.
Single to win the game.
Tied 4-4
yep.
In the eighth inning.
They still won it in 12 innings, but my favorite part of the whole thing, like Scott Servais did it really well. Scott Servais, the manager of the Mariners. Ichiro was, you know, they were deciding, right? Is he, and Fleming didn't know, and I think Eduardo Perez was doing color with him. They didn't know when Ichiro was going to leave the game. They said, well, it's bottom of the eighth. Is he going to go out with his team? Looks like the Mariners are taking the field. And the Mariners went out, took the field. Ichiro was out there in right field. Everybody else came off, and they left him to make his exit from the field. But, you know, you can tell when somebody really likes somebody. You know, you can just see the look in the eye and the genuine admiration. And you had just this melting pot of players, you know, different ethnic backgrounds, socioeconomic backgrounds, whatever. Every one of those guys, when they saw him, just had this twinkle in their eye. Like, this is a big moment to them. And they were so excited to be part of it. Like, that, for me, was the best part. Like, he's, by all accounts, he's very funny. You never see him interviewed. He still has my favorite sports quote of all time, talking about how hot it is in Kansas City in August. If you want to know what it is, I'm not going to tell you what it is. You have to look up Ichiro, Kansas City, August, wool sock, and you'll get the full quote. Bob Costas was interviewing him. And, like, But just the admiration that these guys have for this guy who, you forget, back in 2001, he was really a pioneer in a lot of ways. There had been Japanese pitchers. We had Hideo Nomo and Masanori Murakami before him back in the 60s, who had pitched for the Giants, but Nomo was the big pitcher and did well for some time before he started having arm trouble. The first one to really be a good position player was Ichiro, and he was the standard bearer for it. And I still remember watching him break George Sisler's hits in a season record. And I'll always remember sitting here watching this too.
It was an incredible moment, with, as you mentioned, with all of his teammates, all of the coaches giving him a heartfelt embrace as he came off the field. And of course, this happened in Tokyo. He's from Japan. So it was the perfect storybook ending for him to retire on that scene. And, you know, the fact that he didn't get a hit to the opposite field, that would have been tremendous.
That would have been perfect.
But, you know, I really didn't mind what happened, which was he hit a ground ball to short and hustled down the line as hard as he could.
He almost beat it.
He almost beat it.
He's 45.
I mean, that's the way he played. He, you know, he used his speed. And here he is at age 45.
Yep.
Still being a threat with his speed.
Yep.
And, of course, he is your long-lost brother.
We have the same birthday.
October 22nd, 1973.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just a really special moment. The connection is great. It's fun to talk to you about him because of that connection. I guess
he's a little bit more like, I was watching him on TV this morning, and I said it to Maggie because she was eating her breakfast in there in between. And, you know, she's going out and hitting on the net in the garage. And then I'm like, hey, he's up again. She comes back in. So we're watching it and going back out. And I said, God, he looks younger than I am. Like, he doesn't have the crow's feet and, you know, the random face wrinkles and whatever. And, of course, my wife says that's because he doesn't spend his life in the sun. fair enough. But
he's got a lot more gray hair than you.
He has a lot more gray. I made that comment as well. And then the other piece, as he was coming off the field, you know, sometimes something is said or something happens and you can almost see somebody age right before your eyes. Like, he went from being young and playing baseball and not really thinking about it to almost having this what's next sort of moment. And he came off the field and he had aged minutes, but he looked years older.
He did. I mean, you could see it on his face. He realized and felt that this was it.
It sucks.
Yeah.
Like, there's, yeah, I have no better way to say it. Like,
but it's just incredible because he has over 4,000 hits as a professional. He has the all-time world record for hits.
Yeah,
he had over 1,000 hits in Japan as a professional. Then he comes to the U.S. and has over 3,000 hits. 10-time All-Star, 10-time Gold Glove winner, an absolute hero to not only all Japanese baseball players but to all fans of baseball.
I was gonna say, should be like, he played his heart out for years, and you know, you see him make those throws and just flying around the bases. Just a fun, complete player. All those Gold Gloves that you talked about, the year after year after year of 200 hits. You look and he's 45 years old and he's still flying down the line. And he's one that I hope somebody will, I just really hope somebody finds a way to bring him into a front office, a field position. Maybe we can find a way. My wife pointed out to me that she says, wait a second, that's Prieto. They're twin brothers. You and I were texting about this. The third base coach for the Mariners is the twin brother of a guy that played for a team that I worked for in Kansas City ages ago. But I would be interested in talking to Chris and saying, tell me about this guy. Like, I need more. Like, I need to know more. Like, what I see on the face isn't quite enough, but it's, you've watched this guy sort of be an encyclopedia of baseball for a really long time, be a great ambassador to the game. And it's really only fitting that for his last couple of games, he does it in Japan. And, I really hope that he'll have opportunities to continue to do something in the game, because he talked about it when he first mentioned retiring last year, that this is so indelibly, inextricably intertwined in who he is that he wouldn't know what to do if he wasn't part of it anymore. So I hope he has the opportunity.
Yeah, he's the definition of a baseball player, a baseball lifer. The fact that he's still playing at 45, and I mean, just the numbers are incredible. He has all those hits, but oh, by the way, he hit over 100 home runs, and he had 509 stolen bases. That's just in Major League Baseball.
Yep.
So just, and you mentioned his arm. He's also, he had a phenomenal arm. So one of a kind, really, and a terrific moment this morning.
All told, 4,367 hits. Like, the numbers they're throwing out, like, anybody who played baseball would probably have given you a vital organ or have given a vital organ for one at-bat in the major leagues. This guy's got 14,000, almost 15,000. Share the wealth, dude.
He has lived in the batter's box.
I mean, like that.
And on the base paths.
Insane. Yeah, 4,367 hits. Like, it just 2,078 runs. I don't know. It just impressive to see and a fitting way to go out. So with that said, we're going to go out from this segment. We will come back, record this tomorrow, and we need to do our March Madness brackets. I already did mine, so I'm just going to print it out.
That works.
All right. And then, I don't know, you guys are going to be thoroughly bored while we sit here and go over March Madness. So anyway, you've been listening to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. So I'm going to run something by you. Oh, by the way, it's Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. Welcome back. So I'm going to run something by Hanson here. Let's say you're a Major League Baseball player.
Yep.
And somebody offers you a fortune to sign. You've been in the Major Leagues 4 years. You're not arbitration eligible. Somebody offers you an ungodly sum of money. And by that, I mean 6 years, $100 million. Do you take it?
6 years for $100 million depends on who I am.
If you're Alex Bregman, do you take it?
Ooh, that's a good one. So how many years of free agency are they avoiding with that? I think 2 years.
I want maybe three.
So it's two or three. For him, I probably would, because you're getting a bunch of money up front that you'd have to wait for. You're taking all the risk out of the equation.
Right.
You're locking in $100 million, and you, in years five and six, maybe you lose $10 million per year. But I think the trade-off is worth it.
As a peon, and I don't understand these things, somebody wealthier than I am may be able to shed some light on this, but here's what I want to know. How much more marginally happy are you if you are making $36 million a year, basically, which is what Mike Trout is making for all intents and purposes, versus making $15 million a year? Like, you get to a point, really, where it's complete monopoly money, and yeah, Trout's making $21 million more a year, but how much can you ever really buy? Like, basically, all of Bregman's descendants are going to have money. Like, everybody. Like, kids that he hasn't even had yet. Wife that he may not have yet. They should all be fine. And if he's smart about it, Mike Trout is also set. And, I mean, you know, I hope that with the guys, you know, that are making a ton of cash, you set up other things so that you're kind of extending the hand to those that are still making their way up. You want to give others the opportunity to, and by all accounts, Mike Trout's a good community guy and we'll do that.
Absolutely.
So, but what I look at is, what's your level of happiness? So there have been studies done in the Olympics, and we have about a minute and a half, where it says the gold medalist is the second happiest winner. The silver medalist is the least happiest because they realized that they were so close to being at the top. And the bronze medalist is actually the happiest because they got something, but there's not that, oh, I could have had it. And there aren't the pressures that come with winning it all. So I look at Bregman and I go, $15 million a year, I could live multiple lifetimes and not make that amount of money.
Yeah, so to your point, he's the bronze medalist. He just locked in a spot on the podium.
Yeah,
for himself and his descendants forever. Yeah. If he manages his money with any degree of rationality,
right?
Trout is the gold medal winner, and Mookie Betts is looking at silver medal,
right?
Because they're talking about, will the Red Sox extend him? He's 2 years until free agency, making $20 million per year right now, And Mookie says, you know what, I think I'm going to wait unless something changes. So he doesn't want to be the silver medal guy. He doesn't want to get 12 years for 350. He wants to wait and get the Trout bank in a couple years. And so he's really betting on himself. So props to Mookie for betting on himself.
Yes.
But yeah, I think Bregman in this situation, he locked in the bronze medal and he's got that amount of happiness where he doesn't want to risk. Yeah, I want to get it a little bit higher potentially with like Trout, because otherwise, if I don't get there, I'm off the podium and then I'm not very happy at all.
Right. But what if, let's just say for sake of argument, what if Trout has a couple years where he hits 270 with 30 home runs and 90 runs batted in and steals 20 bases? For the rest of the world, those are great numbers. For a guy that you're paying the mid 30 millions for a year, it's what's wrong with Mike Trout? Bregman puts up numbers like that. Everybody goes, this guy's still a deal. We're still getting a deal with Bregman. Not to mention, if you're the Angels, and this we're going to get off in about 30 seconds. If you're the Angels and you're Mike Trout and you want to have a career where you win, now Artie Moreno's got to really build around this guy, but immediately he's got this one salary line taken up. Like if you look at any of the major league franchises, you have the big dog. So if you're the Dodgers, you have Kershaw and you have the other big names that are eating up 2/3 of your salaries. And then you have a bunch of guys still making good money by normal human standards, 600 grand a year. But though you need to be, you can't make any mistakes with anything. You need to draft perfectly, sign perfectly, fill your roster out perfectly. You can't have guys that are just taking up space. So we'll see what happens. I also keep referring to Rob Manfred. It's a shame that Mike Trout really hasn't done anything to market himself.
Seriously.
He's missing out on a big payday.
He is. Nobody values him.
Nobody values Mike Trout. All right. That said, it's another week of Fox on Sports here on Bedford 105.1. Our thanks to Marty Myers, our guest, the Bedford High hockey coach. Thanks to everybody here at the station, Bill, Colleen, and Harry. And thank you to you for listening. Have a great sports week. We'll catch you next time. You've been listening to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1.